I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
Talk is Jericho, baby. Talk is Jericho. Talk is Jericho, mama. Talk is me.
We originally met in the owner's box, Shad Khan's owner's box in Jacksonville, and it was a very random occurrence.
Wait, did we meet in Jacksonville or did we meet in Kansas City? I remember you from
Kansas City.
Kansas City, yeah.
That's it, Kansas City, right. We met at the playoff game last year.
The very end of that epic run.
Yeah, and you are like the self-proclaimed world's biggest Jags fan.
I don't know that I am self-proclaimed that. I guess I would make that argument, but I do think that crown has been thrust upon me because I think most people in Hollywood have never met a Jaguars fan. I think they are associating me with that, which has as much to do with them as it does with me, though I'm honored to have the mantle.
So what is it about the Jags that you're so into? Like, you're not from Jacksonville.
No, the story is that I grew up in a very rural part of New Jersey, and this isn't going to make any sense either, but to a family of Lions fans, because my dad grew up in Newark, which also doesn't make any sense, but we're Jewish. And so the only game that he grew up seeing that wasn't a Jets or a Giants fan, and he's a guy who cannot go with the crowd, was the Lions on Thanksgiving. So Detroit, everything has always enamored him. And I grew up as a Lions fan and a Tigers fan and all that, watching Barry Sanders. And by the time that I was like eight, what I've been told is that my mom, I was starting school. My brother was too. My mom was worried that we weren't going to have any friends because we were Lions fans. And so she went to my dad and said, "You can't do this to your children. It's not fair. They're going to suffer too much." And I guess that hit a chord with him. And I was told when I was 8 years old, I was like, "You can do whatever you want, but you're actually forbidden from being a Lions fan. Just don't be a Jets or a Giants fan. Don't be like one of the crowd." And it was 1995. And it was the Jaguars' first year. And to an eight-year-old, I think, to see those colors and that logo and that new design, it was like catnip. I loved it. And there are a lot of people my age who I've met who are out-of-town fans who it was just like the year that they popped on the scene, they were just magnetic. And then they were good, like, right away. So there's a lot of a lot of good reasons to be a Jaguars fan in the 90s.
When did you start kind of getting involved with the Khan family and getting them to where you can hang out like a big shot in the owner's
a big shot? Yeah, because anyone who knows me knows that big shot is not how I would self-identify. So it's a fish out of water thing. So I'm on this show on CBS called Ghosts, which has been a dream come true,
which we'll talk about. Big hit on CBS.
Thank you. Yeah, and about 2 years ago, right around now, the show was airing season one, and I got a message on Instagram from the Jaguars, and I was like, whoa. And I would post about the team, and they asked if they could get my email, and I gave them my email gladly. And then I was asked to hop on the phone with someone in Christy, who's in the branding department. And she was basically like, "So are you really a Jaguars fan? Is this like a real thing?" And I immediately went into my whole like railing on them for hiring Urban Meyer, who I thought was a waste of a coach and just a horrible thing. And she was like, okay, I get it. You're a Jaguars fan. point taken. And she was basically like, "Look, we don't have anyone like you, so come on down. We want to bring you into the family." And that was music to my ears. And she was like, "Whatever you want, you know, we'll do." And I was like, no. "Whatever you want, I'll do gladly." So they started bringing me down for games and just met people every time. And I think I freaked some of the local personalities out because I've been listening to Jaguars media in the gym or just, you know, my whole life. And I know everyone and knew all the voices and the personalities. And they were like, "Who is this guy?" And so, you know, one thing led to another. And eventually I got to meet Shad, and who was amazing and such a cool guy, and his story is incredible. And slowly got to meet the family, and then that, and so all that kind of happened that 2022 season. So I met you at the tail end of that,
right?
Where we were on this run, and we kept winning, and I was like, okay, I'm coming back down. I would fly down from Montreal for these games because it was just miraculous to see what they were doing.
Is that where you guys filmed Ghost in Montreal?
Yeah.
Gotcha. So you're actually a traveling fan to where you would fly to the games as much as you possibly could.
Yeah. When you're shooting a show, the big X factor is, can you get that Monday off?
Right.
There's no direct flights from Montreal to Jacksonville. That may surprise you, but there are none. So it's always a little bit of a trek. But that season, I mean, short of like maybe that 96 season, was probably the most magical season we've had. So I was thrilled to be part of it. Or I guess we witness it. I wasn't part of it, but just to witness it.
You're part of it. You're part of it. Because we'll talk a bit more. You actually got involved. You mentioned Urban Meyer, though. It was funny because I was getting into the Jags.
This is the moment you're going to tell me you're like best friends with him, and I've just thoroughly.
No. But I do. If I could swing the camera up here, we did a stadium stampede where we had a whole big match in the Jaguars stadium. We did two of them.
Yes.
And the first one was completely during the pandemic. Second, we were just coming out of it, so we could kind of still be around people.
And you did a promo with him, right?
We did a promo with him, but he actually was in the match where I was chasing MJF through the back area, and we go through the coach's area, and Urban was there with another coach. I can't remember what it was, an African-American dude, and we had them become a part of it to where they were going over their plays on the computer. And I said, throw me the football. And they threw me a football, and I threw it at Max's head.
Yes.
And threw another one at his head.
I remember this.
Yeah, and then afterwards, he signed it. So I was like, oh, that's pretty cool. I got the coach of the Jags with a signed football, you know, which 2 months later, I realized he's like the scourge of the NFL. What do I do with the football? It's a nice football. I like the football.
You keep the football.
I got to keep it. So I have it in my office. So I have a piece of Urban Meyer merch in my office.
I'll tell you, my dad is a, you know, diehard Lions fan, but he's, you know, he's a very, it's hard to get a spontaneous moment of emotion out of my dad. And I once, through a friend of a friend, was able to get him a signed football from Matt Patricia, who was the Lions head coach at the time.
Oh, wow.
And I gave my dad this ball, and he was flabbergasted. He was just blown away. If you're a Lions fan, you also know that ball has aged horribly, because the Matt Patricia era in Detroit was just atrocious. So now, you know, it's like it's on his mantle, but he's also like, ugh, that ball, you know, it's decreased in value. He dreams of getting their current coach to cross out Matt Patricia's name and sign his own.
The new one on there. Yeah. But you actually
you could do that. You could have Doug Peterson just cross out Urban.
I could. Like I said, I've got a Paul McCartney signed bass and an Urban Meyer signed football. So that's kind of my autograph collection.
The yin and yang on the same level. There's a big difference there.
But when I said that you were a part of the team, you did do a short film for their schedule when I guess they released the schedule. Was it last year?
Yeah, it was this time around this time last year.
So,
yeah.
So talk about that. That's pretty interesting. Like it's kind of a cool task to have, and how do you do that?
It was kind of like a perfect storm of a lot of things. That, you know, there has been this ongoing joke about, because the NFL has gotten so epic and these finishes are amazing, that the whole thing is rigged, you know, that it's all scripted.
Of course. Yeah.
And so coming from the world of scripted television and comedy and everything, you know, if you have a seed of an idea, the key to really amping up the funny is just take it all the way down the path. How far can you go with it? And so they approached me around this time last year and was like, we want to do something with this scripted joke for the schedule release. And usually schedule release videos, I don't know how familiar you are with them, but it's usually like a kitten in a box and you're like dangling like the opponent's mascot in like cat toy form. You know, they're very clickbaity and, you know, no offense to anyone who's done them, but it's nothing deep. It's just a fun little thing. And so the idea, and the Jaguars were so, and I think this is a reflection of the Cons too. You know, they kind of came to me and said, we want to make this thing. We don't know how to do it. And we have a feeling that you might. initially I was very reticent because I was like, if this thing fails, I'm going to get blamed for it. And I don't want, I don't want the buck to stop here. But the more I thought about it and they brought me into meetings and I got to meet everyone involved. And then eventually I was like, okay, let's all write a script. And if you like mine, if after you've seen it and seen everyone else's, you like mine, we'll go ahead with it. And that's what happened. And there was just a wonderful sense of collaboration and I guess humility, but like a creative, I think a lot of these businesses they're very siloed off. And we had people in like six different departments who were all working together to make this thing happen. And I was very grateful to be handed the reins. So write and direct it. And they were basically like, all right, what do you need? How do we do this? It was like a fun adventure that we were all on. And everyone bought in. You know, Trevor was in it. Tons of the players were in it. Shad was in it. Doug Peterson was in it. And they were all taking this risk that, you know, I think we think of professional athletes. I mean, you're actually kind of this is probably wouldn't even be a blip on your radar, because I think performance and the story of what you do is always ever present.
Sure.
But for a football player, you're just playing the game.
Yes.
You know, so the idea of getting in front of a camera as a football coach or a player and playing a character, even if that character is like a pseudo version of you, can be a little terrifying. And everyone was 100% committed, and we improvised, and people were down to clown. And it was the kind of thing where once we worked with one person, they would tell someone else, and then other people would want to get involved. And it kind of snowballed, and we got to do this thing that was a much higher concept than people were used to. And I guess it was my love letter to Jaguars fandom. And hopefully Jaguars fans saw themselves in the video.
What was the storyline of the video?
It was like a mockumentary, and taking the audience, if the NFL is indeed scripted, then it's taking the audience behind the scenes into the Jacksonville Jaguars writer's room. So you could see them come up with the season. And then also the idea is that they're writing these episodes, these games, and then giving the scripts to the actors, and the actors are rehearsing all week and then performing on the weekends. So you're watching these athletes, Zay Jones, Trevor Lawrence, Jamal Agnew, all these guys, Tyson Campbell, learning how to play themselves and doing acting exercises and vocal warmups and improv games, all in pursuit of making this little play come to life. And you know, we did little bits with it. You know, Zay Jones had an existential crisis. You know, if he's Zay Jones playing Zay Jones, what does that mean? Who is he? It was a whole thing, all kind of send up of this NFL scripted idea. And it was, I think, just a way to kind of see another side of these players and the personalities and the team. We had a whole bit in there that Doug Peterson isn't really a football coach. He's just a regional theater actor. This whole world is new to him. His real name is Pug Dieterson, but Doug Peterson is his stage name. So just a lot of little witty little pokes of the NFL and the Jaguars are great. I mean, we had jokes in there about Urban Meyer. The Jaguars had a real sense of humor about the last few years. So as a fan who loves writing and directing and doing this, it was like everything I love in one pot.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Well, when you're talking about acting and directing, it's interesting because just the other day, and I love when stuff like this happens. It happened with a couple of interviews I did last week. But the other day, we find out about the passing of Louis Gossett Jr.
Yeah.
One of the very first movies I can ever remember seeing, because it was at the drive-in with my parents, was a movie called The Deep in 1977. I've watched it probably about 5 or 6 years ago, and the heel is Louis Gossett Jr. His, like, underling heel is played by Eli Wallach, who is amazing when I'm looking at your career bio.
Yeah, you've done your research.
Well, and I don't usually do a lot of research. I basically just read Wikipedia or have Stacy send me a few notes. And I see that you did a short film starring Eli Wallach basically around the time that right before he passed away, it looks like. Yeah. I've never talked about Eli Wallach in 10 years of Talk is Jericho. So kind of tell me some of your memories of him and how you got such a prestigious award-winning actor to be in what I'm assuming is a student film.
Yeah, basically. It was a short film, and the seeds of it started when I was still in film school. Just to start off, I had no business having Eli Wallach in my movie. This was an act of generosity on his part. So basically what happened was I wrote this thing about a Holocaust survivor, which was based on a true story of a guy that I had met. And this may shock you, but finding an actor who's in his 80s or 90s who's still doing it and wants to be in your movie,
right,
in your movie when you've done nothing, it's very hard to do. And I just couldn't find anyone to play this role. And I even had gotten to the point that I had gone out and asked the real man to play himself. And it wasn't something that he was comfortable with. And it just wasn't going to make sense. And on the way back from meeting him, I got a phone call from Roberta Wallach, who is Eli's daughter. And Roberta's an amazing actor. And she and I had been in an acting class years prior, and she had recently seen somehow an audition that I had just done and was calling me and saying, "Hey, I remember you from way back when." She didn't say this, but it was kind of like, "You were a moron. You look like you're doing much better now. Really good work, you know." And I was like, "Roberta, I cannot believe the kismet here that you're calling me, because I have written this thing." And as you know, as someone who knew Eli's work, anytime you thought of an old Jewish man, Eli Wallach was like the poster child.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said, "I've written this thing essentially with your father in mind. And is there any way, I know this is a big ask, that you could share it with him?" And she was like, "No."
Even just saying it is like, oh my gosh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So she was like, I'm pretty sure she was like, "No, that's not what this phone call is. We're not doing this." And I was like, "Okay, well, can I just send it to you? Like, maybe you can look at it." And she was like, "I don't know." I was like, I'm just going to send it to you. And, you know, if you get to it, you get to it. If not, don't worry about it. So I sent it to her. I didn't hear anything. I started casting some other roles in the film. And it just out of the blue, one day I got a phone call from an older man with this French-Belgian accent, which is what the character would have. And he just started talking in this accent. And I was like, "So who is this?" And eventually he revealed himself to be Eli.
Jeez.
And he was like, "All right, so when are we doing it? What's the plan?" And so I guess he had read it and he liked it and thought it was something fun. And it wasn't like he was sitting on the couch. He had just done an episode of Nurse Jackie and was nominated for an Emmy for it. I think we shot this shortly after he did that. And I remember I was terrified because this guy, he's a legend. He'd been around forever. He was Marlon Brando's landlord. he was an icon. And he could not have been lovelier. He showed up on set with like gifts for everyone and just kind of held court telling these stories. And he would tell a story. We would go from one of his stories and roll right into the script. And he was so easy and playful and had like one of these faces where like, every time he had a thought, you could feel it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just like hypnotic to watch. But yeah, just it couldn't have been lovelier. And it was kind of an honor that I was unprepared for and then tried frantically to get as prepared as I possibly could for it. But yeah, my first time directing, and I had Eli Wallach in my movie. I was terrified.
If you look at his career bio,
it's insane.
It says the train, he plays Andre, short film, posthumous release, his final film role. Final film role of a career that lasted 80 years was in your short film.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Remember when I said that this like imposter syndrome? That just makes it worse when you highlight that. His performance in The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly sits in like four genres at once. It's like an amazing performance. And I remember I did a Baby Doll is a film, Tennessee Williams film that he did when he was younger. And it was his, I think it was the one he talked about the most. And I think it was one of his proudest, not his proudest performance. It was like one of the first things he ever did. And he's amazing in it. He's like, from one second to the next, you never know what he's going to do next. And years later, I got offered to do the play version of it and did it just because I was like, I want to. He had relished the experience of shooting it so much. And I was like, I want to see what this thing's about.
Right.
And it was one of my favorite experiences on stage. But he was lovely. And every time I would go to his place, he lives here on the Upper West Side, and he'd give me the same tour of his apartment. And he's like, in case you missed this last time, I was going to show this to you one more time. He showed up with pictures from World War II that he was showing everyone on set when we shot. He was so generous and lovely, and I got so lucky.
What did you learn from him, you know, as an actor and as a professional, being a young guy just getting into the business?
I mean, just as a person, I think generosity is huge. Mm-hmm. He was lovely to every single person that he met. But from a craft standpoint, that ease, that idea that we call action and you're supposed to transform and become this other thing. And it's like, it's supposed to be night and day, right? But fundamentally, the engine of storytelling is being human. And there's this spontaneous, unpredictable thing to being human, to being alive. And that spontaneous thing is what makes stories fun to watch, because you just never quite know what a person's going to do next. Mm-hmm. Like, the script is predetermined. You know what's going to, you know, the actor knows what's going to happen. But how do you make that thing that is predetermined feel like it's unpredictable?
Right.
Eli would be chatting with me, telling a story or something. We would call action, and he would just roll right into it. And that same life and spontaneity and electricity, that wouldn't change. It was right there, whether the camera was rolling or not. And it made everything he did magnetic. So I think as an actor, and there's always a structure to it. There's always, you got to hit a mark. And I know you've done a ton of acting. There's always, you got to hit a mark. You got to hit a moment. You got to, you know, There's a requirement to tell the story. But how can you flow from structure to structure to structure in a almost chaotic way that makes it feel like you're really watching life unfold in front of you? That was the big, and I don't think that I really grasped the weight of that lesson when I first got it. And as the years have gone by, it's kind of like settled in more and more and more. And I hopefully get it on a deeper and deeper level, because It's usually, I think with acting, I'd be curious to hear your thoughts, but it's not that there's a ton to learn. It's just getting it from here to being an impulse.
Yeah. It's being comfortable. You know what I mean? It's I equate it kind of to when you're singing a song, like with my band, if you're learning a new song, you're thinking about the words and trying to remember what's next, your performance suffers.
Yeah.
It's when you get into the groove of the song that you've sang many times and you can start thinking about, you know, oh, do I have an extra pair of socks for tomorrow? And you're still singing, but you're thinking other stuff. I think acting is kind of like that as well. When you're so dropped in, you're not even thinking about the lines. You're just performing.
That's a great way to put it. My acting coach has this thing where he says, you never think about how to walk home. You just do it. First time, you maybe move to a new place, then you're thinking about it. But usually as you're walking home, you're thinking about 500 different things.
Yeah.
And you want to get to the point that you're operating like, you're just operating on behavior.
Yeah, it's right. Yeah.
You're operating on instinct.
Yeah. I remember when I was my acting coach, when I was like, yeah, I'm off the book. And he's like, oh, great. So you memorized your lines? Good. So you're a good memorizer then. That's great. Congratulations. Okay. Can you deliver them worth a shit, please? Because it's not working right now.
Yeah.
And you're like, okay, I thought it was all about memorizing lines. That's what I thought acting was, right?
Yeah. Yeah. That's always the question. How did you learn all those lines? And then, and I think one of the tricks as an actor is that transition from saying, oh, I have to learn lines to, no, I have to kind of learn a story.
Yeah.
And then live that story.
And the vibe of it. What's the vibe of what I'm trying to get across, right?
Yeah. And live that story with a camera in your face and a light over here and a mic you got to hit and a mark you got to hit and, you know.
Yeah.
Not step on someone else's line.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
Let's talk about, I mean, the biggest success of your career, obviously, is Ghosts. It's not like you had a ton of credits before that. And there's a lot of short films.
Yep.
And there's, you know, a handful of guest appearances on amazing shows like Succession, which is awesome. But then suddenly you hit Ghosts. So I know you're not an overnight sensation, but it's not like you had dozens and dozens of credits before you finally hit, you know, the big role.
it's crazy to say, but I've been doing this basically for like 20 years since I was like 13 or 14 or something like that. And
right.
It's funny. People have multiple reasons for why they get into this career. And I feel like I have my reasons for being in the career. I've kind of changed and morphed over time. And as they've changed, the way that I approach it has changed. And this, it also has to do with kind of where you are in your life. I went to college here in New York, and then I moved to California for 6 years, three of them for grad school in theater, and then three in LA. And I remember coming back to New York and just being so much happier, which yeah. I think also had an influence on my work. And then the second I got back to New York, I was working and doing booking things and having lots of fun opportunities. And then Ghost was kind of like, it's funny. I think that we often think that we have to go outside of ourselves to get something. And Ghost was a thing that I had never done a comedy before. This isn't my wheelhouse. It's not. And I'm working now with a lot of people who do improv and stuff like that. And that's not really the world I come from.
Mm-hmm.
But when I read Ghost, I thought the pilot was, it's still my favorite pilot I've ever read. It's just such a unique concept. But I also just understood the guy. Like, this is a guy, I went to college with a lot of guys like this, and it was just kind of like the right thing at the right time. It was a good match between what I was curious about and what I was doing in my work and what they were writing. And I remember in the audition just feeling like, okay, this thing works. I just have to kind of like get out of its way so we can, it's what we're talking about, right? Allowing this thing to kind of flow and allowing the play of it to flow. And the one thing I knew, I was like, this guy could be a little annoying and maybe repulsive. And there's an element of him that's a little bit of like a puppy who's just always looking for a good time. And I thought that was kind of the thing that is the North Star for him. If you can do that, then he's relatable. Mm-hmm. So that was the one thing I just dropped in there. But I've been auditioning for these pilots for a long time.
Yeah.
You can get one and it can never see the light of day. You can get one and never even shoot it.
Yeah.
So we got very lucky in many ways. I mean, the pandemic almost shut us down. A strike shut us down. It's been a long journey to getting there. But I also look back and I'm like, there's nothing else that I auditioned for that I would rather have over the one I got. So I got really, really lucky.
That was always we talk about the scourge of the bit. Pilot season's coming up. Pilot season. It's like, oh, pilot season.
And I'll tell you, I almost didn't even audition for this because I was so sick of pilots. I was like, no one gets these.
Yeah.
I was almost to the point that I was like, I think all these people are just like computer generated
AI
actors. I've never met anyone who got a pilot. Yeah, it's AI.
Mm-hmm.
And there was like a guest star on Blue Bloods. And I was like, I want that. That's what I want to go for because this may actually happen.
Right.
And my agent was like, they really like you for this thing. You have to go in. And I was like, I don't want to go in. And luckily he won.
What did they see that they liked you for? I mean, or did they just see your audition or did they see you in something else?
No, they saw the audition. It's funny, the Trent O'Donnell, who's one of our producers on Ghost and has directed the largest bunch of episodes. That's not the way to say that, but has directed more episodes than anyone. The lion's share, thank you. When I got the job or when we started shooting season one, he showed me his audition list and the notes next to every name. And the note next to my name, I was the first person to ever audition for it. And the note next to my name was, oh, he's great.
Mm-hmm.
He'll never get it.
Really?
Apparently, because he was like, apparently the first person who auditions never gets it.
Right.
First
person
like sets a mark and then everyone.
Yeah. You want to be the last person.
Takes that person down. You want to be the last person. And somehow I survived the onslaught. And it was even at the point where, so you clearly know this world. So you do the audition and then for network, there'd be a studio test. You know, they basically pick like three or four guys who they would like and they send them to the studio. And the studio is like, well, we like these ones. So they narrow that down. They send them to the network. Maybe it's two or three guys at that point. And the network kind of picks.
Right.
I was the only one that the showrunners and Trent had found. And so then there was a waiting period as they found someone else to test against me.
Wow.
And in my mind, I'm like, no, why? We don't have to find anyone else. We're fine. Let's just sit. But I was told that you can't send one person to a network. You have to give them options. Or they're just going to say no to you. So
yeah.
We waited to find someone else and went through the testing process. And over that period of time, I was just trying to do garner goodwill or good juju. And I was doing favors for everyone in my life and trying to pay it forward and just hoping that, you know, the die would fall my way. And I got lucky and it did.
It's such a nerve-wracking experience. I don't think people who aren't in the business don't understand. Like, when you go through all that and don't get the gig, it's pretty crushing. Like, you know, I mean, I had William Shatner on and he gave me some great advice years ago. He's like, if I worried about the gigs I didn't get, I would have lost my mind. But there is that period of time when you lose your fucking mind, when you don't get something. I was perfect. I'm perfect for this. And I spent 8 weeks talking to these people and then a 12-second call. Yeah, we're going another direction. You're like, why did I waste my time? You know?
Yeah. And it's also, there's something with, and maybe this is just to go back to the Jaguars a little bit and getting to know some professional athletes. There is some overlap there, but when you're an athlete, you actually would be the best person to speak on this. There's like this physical thing that you get to, there's a sensation of being up there, right? You're straining, you're in a flow.
Yeah.
And if you're acting, you're in a foreign place, you're up against a wall with a camera in your face and the scene is 45 seconds, whatever it is.
Yeah.
And you have to somehow get from this place of stagnation into this place of flow. And it's not like there's an instrument there or there's something to grab onto. Your scene partner is probably someone who's reading off a page and not even looking to you. And you're supposed to have a spontaneous moment of life with this person.
Yeah.
So the real answer probably to your question of like, how did you go from years and years of quiet to suddenly working was I was a bad auditioner. I had learned how to act.
Yeah, I hear you.
But acting and auditioning are two separate skills. And when I was in LA and beating my head against the wall and couldn't get any work, I kind of was like, all right, we're going to stop focusing on acting and we're going to start studying how to do an audition. And I just started helping everyone that I possibly could with an audition in hopes of trying to glean like, okay, what's the transition that happens here? Because I'd go into auditions and just like black out because I'd kind of be waiting for the start gun to go off.
Yeah.
And then the thing would be over and I hadn't heard a gun yet, you know?
And there's never any help with an audition. It's just like, okay, go ahead. Okay, thank you. Bye. And it's like, that's it. Like, do you want me to try it again any other way? Like, it's a very daunting experience.
And it's funny because now that I'm doing more directing, our showrunners are great. And they just let me shadow Christine Gernon, who was our last director on season 3. And so seeing it from the other side, there really is this thing like actors are kind of taught to speak Spanish and directors and filmmakers are taught to speak English and no one is like, there's this weird like mystery around it.
Yeah.
It's very rare that you get to have access to both sides. And then you kind of see, oh, I get it. I get where these two meet.
Mm-hmm.
But you would never get that in school. You would never get that in acting class. Usually I think acting teachers see you more and more into yourself and then you kind of miss the things around you that are really the key to making this thing pop. It's a very funny dynamic.
So what did you learn about auditioning when you said that? Because I'm not a very good auditioner either. As a matter of fact, I'm not even sure I've ever gotten anything from auditioning. It's usually because they've seen me in something else and just offer it to me. So what is some tips for auditioning that you learned when you actually decided that you needed to focus more on that?
Yeah, I think so. All right. Let's say you want to have a hard conversation with someone. You have to break up with someone or you want to ask someone out or something that would like get your heart pumping. You're in your own head and you're like, oh, I'm going to say this. I'm going to say this. Okay. And then I'll say this. And like you have this whole thing you're planning on doing and you're trying to control the situation. And then the situation arises and you approach that person. Your heart is pounding and your brain is blank and they're doing something that you didn't anticipate. And the whole conversation goes in a different way. Hopefully you let go of the thing that you planned and something new happens.
Of course, right.
And essentially that's how you have to approach auditioning because when you get this scene that is unlike life, like I said, is predetermined in front of you, you immediately want to control the thing or you get like a really good idea, like, oh, I'm going to do it like this. But like we try to do that in life all the time and it never happens.
Right.
So instead of trying to do it away, you can have a point of view on a thing, which is a relationship is different than a result.
Mm-hmm.
And then actually allowing yourself to go in and have a conversation with the reader who is going to be a different person than who you rehearsed it with or who you imagined it with. Like you're actually talking and listening to that person because at any given moment, the spontaneity of what you're creating is more important than the choice you make. And that's not to say that the choice is irrelevant, but if you walk in and you make a choice that you didn't plan, that they didn't expect anyone to make. At least then they're looking at someone who's like, okay, well, I believe everything you're saying. Can you just now try to do it this way?
Mm-hmm.
But if you go in and you're just showing them your homework or showing them a plan, if they don't believe you, there's nothing really to work with there.
Yeah.
And the amazing thing is that if you can work that way, what happens is that you end up actually being in that room. Like there's an essence of you in that room. And from there, you can do anything.
Hmm.
But if you're kind of like showing your greatest hits, we're meeting your head, but not actually meeting you. Does that make any sense?
That makes perfect sense.
So that's the thing that kind of clicked for me.
It's similar to being a podcast host, for example, or any type of journalist. Like you've done tons of interviews now, as I've done thousands. And I can tell right away if it's going to be a good interview or a bad interview, because the best ones, I always think of Larry King, for example, didn't really have a list of questions, didn't really care what you were promoting. What do you got, a show? Ghosts? Sounds great. Okay. But then it would just talk.
Yeah.
And you take this list of questions, if you even have them, and you throw them away and you just talk. Like if we meet at the owner's box at the Chiefs Jags game, I don't pull out a list of questions and go, so Asher, blah, 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 blah. You just talk. And that's the beauty of a good conversation, is there's no direction. You just have a great conversation and listen to each other. And I think, once again, like you said, for a good audition, the less you do what you have planned, probably the more natural it is.
Yeah. I appreciate you bringing it to podcasting, because it actually is, it's a larger thing than just acting. It's the reason we turn on a TV show, or we turn on a podcast, we turn on a movie or something, because if we want to figure out what's going to happen next, and if there is this thing that's happening spontaneously, it hooks us. I mean, it's the reason why sports are like, what is it? The top 100 highest rated like television shows in any given year, like 97 of them are football, because it's the only thing that you never know what's going to happen next.
It's the only thing where advertisers can still make money, because people tune into live TV and they don't binge watch an NFL season. You can't, you have to watch it live and see it as it takes place. Same thing with wrestling. That's why wrestling is so profitable with AEW and WWE, because you can't tune in after. You could, but it's not the same.
No, it's not, and you have to, the whole thing of like, I hope no one tells me what's going to happen. Like there's something.
Right.
It's a thrill of watching something that's actually happening, because you're part of it.
Yeah, suspenseful and it's the unknown.
There's this trick in theater where you're watching a play and something goes wrong. And it's always one of the best things that can kind of happen in live performances. If something goes unplanned, then the actors are a little bit like, oh, shit,
right.
We have to solve this. Then everyone leans in.
Yeah.
Because there's this element of, oh, wait, now we're all in this together watching something that no one knows the answer to. And so the sensation of that is what you're always chasing. It's why improv is so much fun to watch.
So let's talk about when Ghosts, you get cast and it finally hits, and now you're known to America as the guy with no pants, which is great. How was it for you after beating the bushes for so many years and doing all these short films, and now suddenly you're on national TV on a weekly basis with a character that has, and let's be honest, when you have a character with a gimmick, it always gets to the next level. Suddenly you're in the public eye. How was that for you?
You know what's crazy? We've done 3 seasons of this thing. I'm not sure anyone has really asked me that question before.
Okay, there you go.
That's a really good question. On one level, and this is just being a type A driven person, there's a monkey off my back. Because, okay, I finally, like that experience that all my friends in school had when they, like a year or two after they got out of college and they got a job and they could pay bills and things like that. Like, I now finally have that experience. So that's great.
Yeah.
I could pay bills, but I was working on like a substitute teacher salary. But like, it's a very different when you get to do the thing that you wanted to do.
Right.
So there's that. There's also this element of the thing that you thought you always wanted, what that was versus what it actually is.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not a good or a bad thing. It's just, this is much more of a team sport than I think I ever even anticipated.
Interesting.
And I'm sure you probably relate to that. Like it's your face on the screen,
mm-hmm.
but the amount of people who are making sure that light's in the right spot and that you hit that light and the sound and the camera and the set and the costume, all of this stuff. And then there is this element of, everyone is seeing it. There's this weird, almost like social media-ness thing of it, because fundamentally it is a public-facing job.
Mm-hmm.
And whether people like it or not matters on a scale that if you're just auditioning for stuff, there are people whose opinion matter, but there aren't that many people who are seeing that work. And that has always made me very grateful for the previous thing I said, which is it's a team sport. So there's this ensemble that I'm working with. You know, we're all figuring this thing out together. And I'm very fortunate with Ghosts that there's a loyal fan base and people are excited by the show. And that the thing that I saw, that I think we all saw on the page and were excited by, audiences have gotten excited by. But there are definitely, you know, there are some days where, just to bring it back to the pants, where you kind of want to hide a little bit. You don't want to take your pants off on national television. It'd be nice to just be a little, you know, covered up for a second. Yeah. But it's your dream job, so you take your pants off. Yeah, it's I'm not complaining at all. But I remember one of my castmates after season one and every season since then being like, all I want to do when we're done shooting is go somewhere and be very, very small. Mm-hmm. And I get that. I get the idea of, okay, we're out, we're doing this thing, and now you just kind of want to hibernate. And I think you kind of need both in life. I think it's probably very healthy.
How is it working? I mean, you mentioned it's a team sport and with the ensemble. The Ghost is the epitome of an ensemble cast. There's 10, 12 leads on this show. Yeah. I don't even really even know what my question is, but I guess every week when you get your script, is the first thing you do is look for your stuff? Is it, like, are you not cool, but you understanding just how many people are in this show and how much FaceTime sometimes you'll get and not get depending on the episode?
I think that happens, but I don't really have like a cellular response to that, or at least I haven't since season one, because season one, there isn't really a show. It's what you're saying. It's an ensemble show. There's 10 of us and we each have our hand in the cookie jar and you're never sure how many cookies you're going to get in any given episode. And because there's no show on television that is kind of a similar, mm-hmm. there was a little bit of like, okay, how much does the average workload feel? Because when you're away in a foreign country shooting a television show that you're doing season one of, there's always a voice in your head when you don't get as much as someone else that you're like, okay, they're going to fire me.
Yeah.
Season one, there was a calibration process to that. Like, okay, this is what it's going to feel like. This is normal. This is not something to be alarmed about or to get like crazy about. The thing that is very unique about our show, I think, is that because everyone has come from a theater background or an improv background, or in Devin's case, a football background, we're all coming from a place where there's a real team mentality to it. So, you know, if you shoot in television, what happens is you go to set, read a scene one time, director puts you where you're going to stand. You do the scene one more time, and then we invite the crew in to watch and you do the scene a third time. That's rehearsal. That's the whole thing. There's nothing else.
Right.
So you read it three times and then cast leaves, crew sets up. I think on a lot of shows, what happens is cast leaves and they all go back to their trailers. They go back to their spots, do whatever they're going to do. Our cast leaves and we all go over where our trailers or rooms or holding area is. And we all huddle together and start working out ideas and things that we could try and figuring out the scene together as a group. Hmm. So there's this ensemble take on it and a kind of group ownership over the thing. Almost Greek chorus-y, but like, okay, if I do that, is this funny if I try that? Okay, what do you think if I do this? And we have created a very safe space for everyone to fail and just fall flat on their face, which I think is what has led to when people say like, oh, it seems like you guys all really get along, or oh, there's some great chemistry on screen. I think it's that thing. It's that thing that we still, and we will do that for 14 hours and then go out to dinner with each other because we're all like codependent. And so that kind of psychological syndrome that we share is also working in our favor. But yeah, it is a thing that I think would probably might frustrate a lot of actors, but it's the saving grace of the show. It has a let us all play. And it's fun, I think, for audiences because you with any given character, you're kind of left wanting a little bit more. Because we touch on a thing and then we move on to the next story. We move on to the next story. And there's early on, people were like, oh, well, this is a Trevor episode or this is an Alberta episode. And that kind of logic, I think, has floated away. We've come to realize this is really a team thing. Because, you know, a story may be about one character, but everyone is in pursuit of that story. It's a great dynamic. And I think a rare dynamic.
That's interesting. And as we start to wind down, you just touched on this. Like we started this show with the Jaguars discussion. This is a team now. You have this whole team of people. And I'm sure it's now that you've been renewed for fourth season, which I'm sure is always a little nerve wracking. Are we going to get back into it? You're probably closer every season that you continue to have this job and this chemistry between you.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. Actually, I think the thing that really got us close in the beginning was we booked to this thing, or at least most of us did. A few people were added later on, but most of us booked this thing in March of 2020, and we were in LA to shoot the pilot, and then the world shut down.
Right.
So we sat in this like limbo for, that was March. We shot the pilot in December. So what is 7 months? And it's kind of sitting on this life raft in the ocean, wondering what's going to happen, or is our dream job going to happen or not? And for everyone in this show, I think this is the biggest job that they've had to date. So it really meant something, and we all represented a pinnacle or an achievement, and we all craved this thing. And so we were having like weekly Zoom hangouts over the pandemic, which also really helps to create a kind of survival mentality. Is very good for team dynamics. You know,
was there ever any talk that the show wasn't going to happen because of the lockdown?
Yes, I think there was. I think we were a little bit protected from that because no one was talking to us. So there was always this sense, and we were watching pilots get dropped left and right. And I remember that pilot season, they were bringing back 30-something, was a big show in the 80s. And
right, that felt right.
Like surefire to go. They wanted to do Patrick Dempsey was returning to television to do a big political show. And as a West Wing nut, I was like, oh my God, that sounds amazing. And that's probably going to go. Ghost, the only thing Ghost had going for it was this really brilliant pilot. So like all the name, you know, the big names and the kind of legacy shows, there were a lot of things that had a much better argument for them than we did. The only thing we had going for us was this really unique concept.
Mm-hmm.
I think just Hollywood landscape, television landscape wise, it probably didn't make a lot of sense that we survived. But because we had read the script, I think our mindset was, if we can just get on air, I would think this thing's going to work. But there was also this element in the pandemic of kind of like standing at the ocean and knowing you have no control.
Yeah, right.
Like
right.
It's just so huge. And I think there was a little bit of a Zen kind of, I don't know what's going to happen, but until they tell us no, I can't feel bad.
While you're on a series like this, and once again, we mentioned it was a hit, it's a fourth season. Do you still keep your eye on trying to do other gigs as well? Or do you even have the time?
No, I do. There have been things that I've been really lucky. I've gotten to do a movie every off season, which has been great, and work with some really fun people.
That's great.
They haven't come out yet, so I'm not allowed to talk about anything, but they have happened. So that's good. And yeah, and I'm auditioning for stuff, and there are a bunch of projects that it's what you talked about earlier, where it's like, if it's right there, it's right there. And then it's, you know, kind of snatched away at the last second. So that stuff never ends. And then also I'm trying to make a little bit of my own stuff. Jag's video was a perfect example of that.
Mm-hmm.
There is an element of when you get done shooting 7 months of a show that you just want to hibernate for a second, but then you recover and you're looking for stuff. We're limited. We're for sure limited just because of timing, and Ghost is obviously the priority, and there's a press schedule for that and things like that. But yeah, you're always looking for something new. And for me, coming from a drama background, I'm also always looking for that. I never anticipated that I was going to be on national television, my pants off in a comedy. That was never the plan. In college, there was a phrase my friends would use, which was an Asher joke, which is a joke that would start and then fail halfway through. So the idea that I'm doing a comedy is laughable.
Have you ever had a ghost encounter of your own?
I have not, but I grew up in what is considered one of New Jersey's haunted houses.
Oh, wow.
Which apparently, and they were friendly ghosts, the story goes, who the house is very old. It was built in like the 1700s. And these ghosts apparently guided the American Revolutionary War soldiers through the swamp lands. So old house mixed with swamp
equals
haunted. Yeah. Though when my parents moved in, this is before I was born, but when my parents moved in, there were a lot of noises in the attic. They got up there and there were a ton of bats. And bats are a protected species in New Jersey, so you can't touch them.
Oh,
so
wow.
They just opened a hole in the roof and stood outside one night and just started counting the bats as they came out. And it was like 300-something bats
wow.
were living in the attic. So maybe it was that.
Old house, swampland, and bats. I'm going to count that as a haunted encounter.
As haunted, sure. Thank you. Yeah. Great.
Last couple of questions for you. What's your favorite episode of Ghosts where you felt you had your best performance or the funniest performance or the one that stands out the most for you?
I mean, the Trevor episode that I think a lot of people talk about that I really loved. Trevor's pants is a lot of fun just because you're treating a missing pair of pants as though it's a murder mystery, which is a lot of fun. The content meets the medium, so to speak. So I love that episode. But I think overall, there's an episode called Pete's Wife that we did really early that I loved. There's an episode called Therapy, which I love that has a joke about a squirrel that I just think is one of the funniest things we've ever done. Those are the ones that really stand out to me.
I love the concept that he has no pants and he claims it's because he had sex with someone. Then you found out he just lent them to his friend.
It's fun. There's something fun about a guy who like he could so easily be a guy who's telling all these stories and they're all bullshit.
Right.
The flip about Trevor is that, no, the stories are all real. The thing he's lying about is that he cared about something.
Yeah. Right. Right. Last question for you, man. What do you think the Jags need to do this year to have a better season?
Oh, man. Stay healthy. Stay healthy. Protect Trevor.
Yeah.
I think they did some good stuff. I think Eric Armstead's a big deal, getting some pressure in the middle. The Calvin Ridley thing does not bother me, though I appreciate his talent. Mm-hmm. They needed help in the middle of the offensive line. But I think the biggest thing is stay healthy. They got some real competition in Houston, and the Colts could be good too. So stay healthy and don't take anything for granted because last year I think we got a little sloppy. And then I hope that I'm sitting with you.
Yes.
This time in Jacksonville playing the Chiefs in the playoffs.
Well, we'll keep in touch. We're officially friends on Instagram. So let's find out what games we're going to. We'll go together.
Please do. Yeah.
Great talking to you, dude.
Thanks so much for having me. This is a blast. You're right. You do a lot of interviews. And so you kind of have these things that you expect to talk about. And I didn't see half of this coming. So this was so much fun. I forgot we were even recording. So
that's always the goal, man. Well, I appreciate it.
Testament to you and how you do this.
Well, thanks, Asher. And congratulations on everything. And let's definitely go to a game this year for sure.
I would love that. Thank you so much. And huge respect for you. And I mean, speak about a Renaissance man. My God.
Oh, well, cheers.
You're amazing.
Well, thanks, dude. I appreciate it, man.
Take care. I'll see you soon.